through amending the statutes is to amend the county clerk statutes to reflect the provisions in the commodity statutes. In Section 1 of Senate Bill 181, which is on the first page of the bill, amends the county clerk statute 205130, which states that orders provided in 645950 shall be recorded in the county clerk lien record. This amendment will allow the department to execute upon the lien for the civil penalty and will provide that such filing will have the same force and effect as execution upon a judgment of a court of record. This amendment allows the department to collect the civil penalties when respondents do not pay them. The security statutes found in Chapter 59 have a parallel provision, and the commodity statutes were modeled after the securities provisions. However, the provisions for commodities in the county clerk lien record were inadvertently omitted during the 1987 session. And that concludes my testimony. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Are there questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Brockman.
How old are these, the $5,000 penalty for every violation? Do you have any idea when that first
Yes,
was?
Sir. The commodity statutes were just passed by the 1987 session, and they were enacted September 27, 1987, so they're about
so
18
that's
months old.
Relatively current, that's
yes,
fine.
Sir.
I'm just thinking if we're having an outbreak of bucket shops selling phony gold commodities, $5,000 isn't a whole lot of money. And we're charged with dealing with the civil penalty in this bill, are we not, as opposed to the bill in general?
That's right.
I don't think that's a whole lot of money.
Well, you're raising the next one, which deals with entities who violate securities laws. So I suppose we could really embark here let's hold that off and
okay.
See what you think about that when we hear about the next bill, which
right.
does raise civil penalties for another classification of violations, if you will. Let's talk about Senate Bill 182 then. There's no one else signed up on 181, and I wouldn't expect that to be any.
Okay. Senate Bill 182 was also pre-session filed at the request of the Department of Insurance and Finance, and the Senate Committee on Business, Housing, and Finance has heard this bill and passed it on to this committee.
Okay, now I want to stop you, Lloyd, because we are in a bit of a rush and say you don't need to go through the whole procedure.
That's correct. I have about a half a page to say
it
to
operates.
This.
let's just go to what you're really asking that's
right.
new with this section.
That's correct. Section 18 is the portion of the bill that this committee is concerned with. The purpose of the amendments in Section 18, which are on page 17 of the bill, are to increase the civil penalties that may be imposed by the director in an administrative order issued against persons or entities who violate the securities laws. The amendments increase the amount of the penalty from $2,500 to $5,000 for each violation, and from $10,000 to $20,000 for a continuing violation. The current civil penalty amounts of $2,500 and $10,000 have been in effect since 1973, and that was the year that the statute was amended to include administrative orders and civil penalties for those orders. Since these civil penalty amounts have not been changed in 16 years, an increase in the amount is long overdue. When an administrative order is issued against a person who has defrauded an innocent consumer out of tens of thousands of dollars, a small penalty of $2,500 is simply the cost of doing business to the con artist. The increases in the civil penalty amounts will allow the department to impose more appropriate penalties for the severe harm caused to consumers by persons and entities who violate the securities laws and therefore give the department a stronger enforcement tool. The security section also administers Chapter 645, the Commodities Code, which was enacted in 1987. The civil penalties under the commodity statutes are $5,000 for each violation and $20,000 for continuing violation.
Okay. So that's what we're having here is a request to raise it as parallel. Senator Brockman, I think, is questioning whether
that's
they
enough.
All ought to be higher, and I
yeah.
want to discuss that.
No, I just wanted to find something here because in this testimony here it says against persons or entities. Now if we're talking about boiler rooms, as you call them. I always call them bucket shops myself, but that's...
That's fine.
Persons or entities. Now, traditionally, a bucket shop's got 15 or 20 people manning the phones.
That's correct.
Now, is the boss of the bucket shop the entity that's going to get the $5,000 fine, or is it each individual person that is on that is manning the wires?
Senator Cohen, Senator Brockman, the way that we charge in our administrative order is against a number of respondents, and we name all the entities that are involved. In a commodities, an example of a recent administrative order under the commodity statutes, we would charge the boiler room operator, all the salespersons, the person in charge of the boiler room, the accounting firm where the money was sent, the mining and refining company that did the bogus deals,
so
the geologist
the
who did that.
They
would all be named in the order,
that's,
yes.
That's fine.
And we...
As separate $5,000 violations.
That's correct, Senator Cohen.
Okay.
Further questions to us? Senator Springer.
Can you tell us, say, in 88 or 87, how many occasions in which it was necessary to levy a fine, and whether in those circumstances the maximum fine was levied, and some idea of the total amount of penalty monies collected?
Senator Cohen, Senator Springer, I don't have exact figures on those. I can give you some pretty good estimates. We issue a number of administrative orders that do not contain fines, and I would guess that probably 90% of our orders contain fines. We can issue orders denying a securities license, and we feel that there's no need to impose a fine on someone for applying for a securities license, for example, so we don't impose fines in those kinds of administrative orders. In the commodities administrative orders that we issued against one of our commodities boiler rooms, we had 12 different persons and entities, and we fined them each $5,000. And then we also charged them with securities violations and fined them $2,000 apiece for securities violations. They range. There are times when there are minor violations, we'll fine $200, $250. I would guess in perhaps 20% of the cases, we would go for the maximum fines. They have to be pretty egregious to go for those fines.
Thank you.
Thanks.
What's a continuing violation as opposed to a single violation? Course of conduct?
Senator Cohen, Senator Shoemaker, we've had a real difficult time trying to figure out what a continuing violation is, and therefore we've never used continuing violation language in our administrative orders. It's unclear what that means, so I've been reluctant to put that in. So I've always used the...
Actually, that's a carryover from Senator Springer. We recognize some of our environmental statutes that had to do with a indication of where we use boilerplate in this business, and it has to do with environmental pollution primarily. That's where that came from in terms of the authority to initially used by civil penalties way back when we gave one single agency 20 years ago the right to do civil penalties, and the continuing violation came in under those circumstances that if you were given notice of violation and you continued to violate, then they gave the opportunity to violate per day or some other kind of thing. Probably doesn't apply to her circumstances, but that's where that language comes from historically.
Well, I see that we have it in both statutes, and of course you want to increase it to $20,000 from $10,000. Would it be worthwhile to define what it is you mean so that maybe you can use it as an enforcement tool? Do you have a concept in your mind about what it is?
Well, it's always been unclear, and we've talked about this a lot, and we've talked about this with the Attorney General's office, and we looked at case law, and we looked in different places where we might try to get some ideas about that. For example, if someone ran, would you say a violation, a single violation would be one investor, one act? A continuing violation would be 30 investors over a month. Is that a continuing violation? Or is placing one fraudulent ad in the newspaper one violation, but if you did it over 3 weeks, that would be a continuing violation? I don't think that we ever sat down and said, well, if we had a magic wand, this is what we'd call a continuing violation. So I haven't come to that yet, sir.
Think it might be useful to do that?
Oh, yes, it would be, certainly. And if Senator Cohen, if you have some ideas, since you know where this language came from, I'd sure like to...
Yes, well, we'll get our staff to talk to you. There are some very explicit rules on what is meant by continuing violations in other agencies around the state that use that language and they have done it by administrative rule under this particular language.
So we could keep the language and just, by administrative rule, define what that means.
What you mean by continuing violation, yes.
Be wonderful. I think that would be a very wise thing for our section to do so that we could use those statutory provisions. Absolutely.
I take it that your action often leads to a civil suit by the victim, and what you do provides them pretty good grounds for an action for damages. And do you find that follows fairly often from what you do, or do you know?
No, not necessarily. I think a lot of when you're a regulatory agency like we are, I think a lot of consumers think that not only are you supposed to go after these people, but you're supposed to get their money back and act as their attorney. So it's real difficult. And I think that by the time we get to some of these people, there's no money left because we don't hear about the violations until people will start losing their money. And then typically the people that we're going after are skipping town and they're hard to find. So I would not say that happens, no.
In light of that, is even $5,000, in light of that plus the fact that you don't pursue what you call continuing violations, is $5,000 more than just the cost of doing business? In other words, are you really going to get at the problem of trying to eradicate this or reduce it through $5,000 penalties?
Oh, yes. I think in fact that when we take an administrative action, there's a whole network of crooks out there, and they all find out that the state is after, you know, one of their group. And the word gets around real fast. It's not, it's not some little quiet thing that happens in Salem. And I do think it's a deterrent when we go through and issue an administrative order and then have the power to file a lien against them. And then they try to sell some property, and there's a lien on that property. They pay the fine. That's happened in a couple of cases in the last year. The other thing that we can do oftentimes is we try to use those penalties as a lever with some of these people to say, well, you want to settle this case? We'll take away the fine if you pay back these investors. We'll reduce the civil penalty or we'll drop it.
Bill, $5,000 is enough.
Well, the reason that I went for $5,000 was because I wanted to raise it. The legislature said last year for commodities we'll give you $5,000 and $20,000, and I sort of felt that that was maybe the limit of what I could go.
I'm not sure it is.
Well, no, I don't think it is.
And one final question. Would it be useful to be able to register a civil penalty as a foreign judgment in a foreign jurisdiction? Imagine a lot of these people come from somewhere else and their real property is somewhere else.
Yes, and we can do that, sir.
Can you do that?
Yes, yes.
Already.
Once it's in the county clerk lien.
Then it is a judgment and it is respected as a judgment in another.
Yes, and Senator Cohen, Senator Shoemaker, what we often do is ask for example, call California Securities and say, hey, can you help us with this? And they can help us with some of their procedures in their states.
New registered. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Brockman.
Just as a point for all of you to chew on, particularly your operation, even when you're playing with real commodity futures, let alone fraudulent ones, $5,000 is no big deal for someone to win or lose when you're betting on the real thing. It's a it's an extraordinarily volatile market. I've seen fortunes made and lost in a week. So it's $5,000 is no biggie.
Senator Brockman, Senator Cohen, I completely agree with you. And we use our administrative process a lot because it's easy and cheap and straightforward.
Okay.
But, you know, and if we could increase those penalties, then that sure would make it easier for us.
Okay. It would have been nice if you had come in with a with, of what you thought would give you what you needed in this. I suppose we could hold the bills over and hear if the committee is interested in looking at it. I'll hold them for another day or two until we bring them up again. But it's only if people want to move ahead. Let's get a sense of the committee who wants to hear from the agency about further increases of in this area. And if that's a sense of the committee.
Madam
I'll Chairman. Hold it open. We can wait for the
maybe
meeting.
That issue could be dealt with as this moves through over
the
on
House
the
side.
Other side.
That's a good idea.
Rather than continue to hold it up, we've got so many bills.
I'm happy to. I don't want to run over this committee, and I've got at least two members who want to do it, and
yeah,
we've got another member who's prepared to make the motion right now to move them out as it is, and maybe that's a suggestion that you ought to take to your. To heart to say that when you come back over, they might have a sense of concurrence. At least you've got a few members here who are interested in your presenting your case to the House and see what you can think on these. Senator Hill, you want to concur to that idea?
Yes, I would concur, since we asked the same question in the Business, Housing, and Finance Committee, and nothing was done there. Obviously, I didn't think that they were prepared, and I assume these are based on the Model Act. Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 181 and 182, the floor to do pass recommendation.
Let's do them separately.
I'm sorry. Senate Bill 181.
Senator Hill moves Senate Bill 181 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion. Could you call the roll, Kiska, please?
Brenneman?
Aye.
Brockman?
Aye.
Brinsky?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Shoemaker?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Senator Hill.
I'm chair to move Senate Bill 182 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Hill moves 182 with a due pass recommendation to the floor. Discussion. Call the roll, please.
Brennan.
Aye.
Brockman.
Aye.
Brenty.
Aye.
Hill.
Aye.
Shoemaker.
Aye.
Springer. Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Thank you. Senator Hill, well, we're here. We're missing you. Springer's gone. He'll be back momentarily. You want to take up Senate Joint Resolution 20?
Yes. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I'll be brief. Senate Joint Resolution 20 is a memorial for former Judge Thomas E. Enright, who was a member in good standing in our community here in Salem. This bill was a bill that was pre-session filed by former State Representative Rocky Berea. This would mean a great deal to former Judge Enright's family and to our community. I urge his passage. Thank you.
Would you like to move? We don't have it as a work session, do we? Okay, well, that's an error. Sorry. Okay. Sorry about that. Then let's close the hearing on SJR 20. Senator Kinnemer is here. Senate Bill 1117. And then let's track down Kelly, Representative Clark. I want to hear from him. Senator Kinnemer.
Thank you,
Senate Bill 1117.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Senator Bill Kinnemer, District 12, Clackamas County. appreciate the opportunity to be before you regarding Senate Bill 1117. I began working back in the summer of 1987 with a group of people and attended a number of their meetings and began to see a group of people who were concerned, diligent, and sincere, and not vindictive, but just out for the good of kids, a group called ACES. And I began to work with ACES during the interim to determine how best to deal with some of their issues. And we established nine major issues. As we developed these issues for the legislative session, we began talking with Wayne Kraft, who's the Deputy DA in Clackamas County, and Jim O'Leary, who is the Clackamas County DA, John Ellis of the Department of Justice, and Bill Cockrell of AFS. And as we investigated these issues, we found that many of them were going to be covered in the Department of Justice's package dealing with the Family Support Act, the Federal Family Support Act of 1988. One of the things that did come out of this was the idea to create a task force to identify issues and to make some recommendations, and that's what Section 2 of this bill is about. I think it's a good idea. It'll make the system faster and more effective. The statistics that I have to date indicate that Oregon currently collects 16.2% of the support that is owed. The national average is 22%. Oregon child support debt last year that was owed through the state was over $242 million. And I think when Brenda Brames comes and testifies, you'll find that she has some other data to indicate a figure perhaps twice as high when you figure all debt. So very substantial debt. I think that allowing this to occur is a very bad social policy. I'm afraid that it tends to teach kids that their parents don't care, deprives kids of their rights to be protected and taken care of, not to mention love, and it fails to hold people responsible. I think that's a bad social policy. Its result is that kids often are forced to live in poverty, and the state's often left with the responsibility of picking up the tab. I think if we can find some ways to increase enforcement of support, that would probably be to the best interest of all of us in Oregon. And I appreciate the opportunity to present my testimony, and great. If you have any questions, be delighted.
Thank you very much. Are there questions?
One question. I note in the packet that there's been some proposed amendments from the Department of Justice, which I think changes the makeup of the committee. And I wondered if you've had a chance to look at that and how you respond to that.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Shoemaker. I think that what's critical is that something happen. And the composition of that committee is something that I really am very open to. And I would be happy to go with this or something that the committee would find acceptable. I think the issue is how can we get better enforcement of support, something I think that's clearly in the best interest of the kids and ultimately all of us.
Thank
appreciate you.
You
bringing that to my attention.
Senator Hill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bill, how much do you think would be needed?
Well, that's a question, and I think Ms. Brames may have some other opinions about that, and I'm not sure. I would like to see it as modest as possible so that it becomes as modest a ways and means issue as possible. That's always the major bugaboo. On the other hand, you're talking about something, you know, when already the state is owed $242 million. By any stretch of the imagination, you would not have to be very successful in the concepts to quickly recoup that in many thousands and millions, perhaps, of dollars over that. So hopefully that's some of the balancing that can be done. But again, that's always the bugaboo we face here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Madam
Great.
Chair.
Colleen Seelock is here to present some amendments.
Good evening, Senator Cohen, members of the committee. I am Colleen Seelock. I'm the administrator of the Support Enforcement Division, Department of Justice. I'll be very brief this evening. I believe you have a copy of my testimony before you, along with the amendments which the Department of Justice would offer. The Department of Justice does not take a position on this bill. However, if considered, we would like to recommend a little bit different membership. We believe that membership is a more representative cross-section of the public as well as the child support enforcement community. Like Senator Kinnemer, We understand that child support is a very important part of today's world, and we are attempting to present a full package, which you will probably be seeing in the near future. Most of our bills were introduced on the House side. They are currently before the House Judiciary, and hopefully will be arriving before you soon. But our position on this bill is one of neutrality. However, we would recommend just a slight differentiation in membership.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Brockman.
I really hesitate to bring this up, but due to your neutrality position on it. Are you satisfied that that your support enforcement is working? And tell me, is your lack of support or negativism towards the bill because you're pretty happy with the way things are going, the way you're doing it, and you're just being polite?
Senator Brockman, members of the committee, no, it is not negativity towards the bill. It really is a neutral position. We really see child support needing a lot of new resources, both to accomplish current federal compliance issues as well as trying to enact some of the new ones we'll be facing because of the Family Support Act. One of the problems that obviously we have is having enough staff, having other kinds of resources to track obligors who are unwilling to pay, to try to locate where they work if they are working. So where we see our position on this particular bill is anytime you can gather a group of citizens together in the interest of improving a program, certainly that's appropriate.
Well, it just, if I may proceed,
please go ahead.
It just seems to me, and I'm not denigrating the bill, but that because so many members of this committee are on it, by the way, among other reasons. But it just seems to me that I can see 9 or 10 people, or however many of them there are going to be, sitting around, and I can't see them coming up with any more creative collection than the Attorney General's office could come up with. I mean, I think you've probably exhausted most of the creative mm-hmm. techniques that you can come up with, but I would hope that that's not the case, but I'll give it a shot.
We would hope not too, Ben. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, I'd like to ask you, how is your division funded? Are you funded on the basis of how much you collect?
No, not at all, Senator Hill. We are funded through, it gets rather complicated, so please bear with me and also feel free to interrupt. Our funding is currently 68% federal dollars matched by 32% state dollars. That will be switching this next biennium to 66% federal dollars. Those dollars are actually appropriated to the Department of Human Resources, AFS. The Department of Justice and the Support Enforcement Division gets their funding from other funds that flow through AFS. AFS is the record keeper of the child support program. Therefore, all of the federal dollars must go into their funds, and then it's all transferred to us.
Senator Kenemer, I don't know if he's still here or not, he told me he was going to be here to discuss this bill, and he said that the national average is that in most states collect 22% of the funds that are owed them, and that we're at 16. I guess it's sort of a follow-up to Senator Brockman's question. If it would seem that if a task, given that we were talking about, Senator Kenner mentioned $240 million mm-hmm. that's owed, and what this would mean to the child and to the daughter, I guess I'm a little... perhaps disappointed that the department is not fully behind this bill and would be encouraging it to be funded at a high level, because we should at least learn something from some other states, it would mm-hmm. seem.
Senator Hill, not trying to sound defensive, there are lots of statistics with respect to the child support programs across the nation. One of the problems the federal government has is there is no states that are identical in the collection of those statistics. So we become somewhat defensive when people start tossing out numbers that aren't fully explained.
Maybe that's why he didn't toss them out, but we had that discussion.
Yeah, we receive a booklet that's about 90 pages long each year, and it is in each page is an individual table with numbers reflecting different kinds of statistics. I can present to this committee certain pages of that booklet that will show you that we are ranked third in the state, in the nation, in our child support program. At the same time, there are new federal audit criteria being adopted to match the Family Support Act that was passed last fall. They just published those. They just sent them to us. They did a review of them on the state's current performance. Oregon was ranked seventh in the nation. I'm not here to say that we can't collect more money. Obviously, it is a very dismal amount that we collect compared to what is owed. But at the same time, I really do want to impress upon you that we have a very good program in the state of Oregon, and it is nationally recognized on many different kinds of aspects. But we do need to do a better job. The entire nation needs to do a better job in recognizing their responsibilities when it comes to paying child support.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Sure. Senator Springer.
How long have you been working with support enforcement over there?
I've been with the division for 2 years, Senator Springer.
2 years?
Mm-hmm.
Seems to me back in 81 or 83 session, at the urging of either the Department of Justice or DHR, we basically decomputerized the record-keeping capability.
Comment that we should pick things up. Being a Republican, we should shift these costs down to the state, and I guess we should be happy to do that. To pick these costs up, even though we don't have the money either. I guess the way that I feel about it is that it is really a travesty that legal aid attorneys are looked upon somehow as being second-class attorneys from the standpoint of the pay that they get from the government. And I bet you there is not another government agency that has taken these cuts in their legal department, and though they probably over time gotten raises. And I think what it is this is a comment on the people that they represent. They represent poor people, so I think that they're looked upon as being second-class attorneys. So that's my editorial comment about this. And if they were regarded as being as important as anyone else, we wouldn't have this problem. We wouldn't be here fighting over increasing fees. I think. Just talking generally about these fee increases, I mean, it's just getting more and more expensive for everybody, regardless of what their reason are for filing lawsuits, and it's just got to stop at some point. I just think the whole thing's out of hand. But I support legal aid and what they do, and perhaps for other reasons than Senator Brennan mentioned, I don't like increasing some small claims court, but I don't know, given their situation, I don't know what else we can do. Anyway.
Sure.
It's true, is it not, that the fees paid by plaintiffs in circuit and district court don't nearly cover the cost of providing that court to them. So they,
sure,
too, are being heavily subsidized by the state in their access to the courts. And all this is saying that it seems fair for those who don't really have access to the court because they're indigent, that those who do and can afford the subsidized access to the court that we as a society provide ought to be willing to kick a little bit in to help those who don't have access. So I think it's, in my mind, it's perfectly fair and not penalizing those who use the courts and can pay to have them help those who can't.
Madam Chair.
Senator Grinsky.
Seems to me that if there is a principle, an equitable principle that says that everyone should have access to the courts, and I'm not necessarily convinced that's true, but if you assume that it is, then that is something that society in general benefits from. Society in general should pay for it. As it now stands, the vehicle for this equity is only on the shoulders of those people who actually go to court, the very same people who will then have legal aid working against them. To me, that doesn't seem equitable. If it's a societal problem, it's a state problem, then the state of Oregon generally should be funding legal services, which I think they should. But we're also asking those people who go to court to pay for it. And I'm not sure that they are the people that necessarily should be then carrying this extra burden simply because they had to go to court to get their problem resolved. And I think, I don't know how this fee thing ever got started in the first place, but I think it's the wrong way to raise money to ensure quality legal services for those people who can't afford them. And for that reason, I'm going to be voting against this bill, although I support legal services and hope we can get funding for them from other sources.
There are no other sources at the moment.
Well, it's a question of priorities. Apparently, the federal government hasn't made it one, and I think that's where the priority should be.
Anybody else? Comments? Call the roll, please.
Brennan?
Aye.
Rockman?
Aye.
Radke?
No.
Snow?
Aye.
Shoemaker?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, we've got one more bill that pertains to Catherine, and I had and I don't want to keep her, so let's move into 412, which is contrary to what I announced in the beginning, but we always do things contrary to what we announced an hour earlier in this business, so may as well, I guess, get onto it earlier. But I do want to let Catherine go home and not wait around to the last for another 3 hours. It might take us.
What?
This is... Unless we get quicker, folks.
This is the bill that limits, or rather, that addresses psychotherapist liability. You have in front of you a set of Dash 2 amendments. These amendments basically replace the existing bill and limit the liability of psychotherapist's duty to warn. The amendments specify the duty to warn is limited to specific parties who are clearly identifiable persons and readily identifiable persons. It also limits the duty to warn to specific circumstances, which are when the patient communicates an actual threat of personal injury directly to the psychotherapist. The bill specifies the duties, how the duty to warn is discharged, and specifically the psychotherapist has the option of telling the party, parent or guardian, and the police, or seeking commitment. And in the case of the PSRB, it must notify the PSRB and also the police. It requires the psychotherapist to notify patients of their duty to warn both at the beginning of treatment and also if there is a threat later on in treatment. It provides immunity for the psychotherapist for giving reasonable warnings. There is no effective date on the bill, and I have drafted a proposed amendment which basically would make the provisions of the bill apply only to causes of action arising after the effective date.
Catherine, we need to know what version of the bill we're deleting. We're talking about right now.
Dash 2 amendments basically gut and stuff the bill. They delete the provisions in the bill and rewrite the bill. And in front of you, you have a we have a typed version of the new bill.
Typed meaning? Redraft of Senate Bill 412.
Right.
That's it?
Right. And then you also have a set of Dash 2 amendments that are LC, and they're dated 3/27/89.
And we're discarding 412-1?
Correct.
And am I correct that the LC Dash 2 amendments are the same as the redraft submitted under date of March 13 by the Oregon Psychological Association?
Yeah. Diane is saying no, but I believe that they were. I'm sorry.
Except for adding.
Could you come up, Diane, please?
Madam Chairman, Diana Godwin, representing the Oregon Psychological Association. They are identical except for in the amendments you see line 13 on page 1.
Of what?
Of the LC-2 amendments. Page 1, line 13, is added that does not appear in my hand engrossed bill.
To seek commitment of the patient under ORS Chapter 426 is added?
Yes. And we agree with that. The psychiatrist asked us to add that back in as one method by which you can discharge a date. And
I'm sorry, Diana, you're probably not aware of it, but John McCulley brought in a hand redraft, which is dated March 13th, which has it typed in.
Because my,
so they are
my
the
draft
same.
Is March 13th, and I didn't realize that. All right. Oh, sorry.
Well, I have one addition with it in and one addition without it. All right. So I appreciate that. Yeah, I have that over here. But over here. That's okay.
Well, episode goes here. Catherine, you have yet another amendment?
Yes, Senator.
Would you pass it out quickly then so we can get it on the table in front of us so we know where we're going to do, if we're not going to do or not do here?
I would like to learn, Madam Chair, whether seeking commitment under Chapter 426 accomplishes what this bill is aimed at. I assume it does, since the psychologist requested it, but I guess I'd like to understand what that does.
Okay, John, you want to come up and explain what sub B in the LC-2 really mean, ORS 426? I assume that's a civil commitment law?
Yes, it is. Madam Chair, John McCulley, representing Oregon Psychiatric Association. This was a part of the original bill that, after all of the discussions, one draft had recommended deletion of it. We requested that it be kept since a physician and community mental health program director could have the ability to seek civil commitment of a person who may be a threat to harm himself, herself, or others. And at the time that that is occurring under this bill, it would be one option that the physician could use to discharge the duty to protect the public.
Madam Chair, what happens when you seek commitment?
A request, the physician can work with another physician and do what is known as a two-physician hold, which allows the person to be held pending an investigation of whether that person will be civilly committed through the court system. The power is also there for the community mental health program director or his designee to seek a hold on that person, which means that, again, the person would be detained until the civil commitment process works its way through and that person is either civilly committed or is released.
Must they be detained under the Civil Commitment Act?
Senator Shoemaker, yes, the detention is to hold that person.
It's required?
It's my belief that, and my understanding that, yes, that is required.
Catherine, why don't you come on up? Quickly.
My name is Laura Sebastian. I'm a psychologist in private practice and chair of the Oregon Psychological Association Legislative Committee. My understanding of the commitment legislation, without looking it up, is that, yes, they are required to hold, provided the person meets the requirements for civil commitment.
Okay, I guess what I'm concerned about, of course, is that they might seek commitment of the patient, but that would be a way to escape liability while permitting the patient to walk out of the office and do the very thing that he threatened to do. But they say, oh, yeah, we're seeking commitment. Therefore, we're off the hook. And if the patient's free.
My understanding, Senator Shoemaker, is that that doesn't happen, or is not supposed to happen, that the commitment to be sought, the hold when it is placed, is that person is detained.
My understanding, Senator Shoemaker and Senator Cohen, is that it is covered under civil commitment, the civil commitment statutes.
Okay. So we want to read for a moment on 426, if you go ahead and do that.
Yeah.
Anyone have comments?
Madam Chair, still following up on the earlier question, it's still not clear to me just what to seek commitment means. Does that mean that a person has initiated by contacting another individual who's necessary or has contacted the law enforcement authorities, called the law enforcement authorities and say, hey, I think this person needs commitment, and then the officer goes out there exercising his or her judgment and takes the person into custody? It's not really very clear to me what that means.
Senator Cohen, Senator Springer, I think that that's covered very specifically under the commitment procedures, the requirements of the person seeking civil commitment, either through community mental health or a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist in private practice.
Charlie, do you want to come up? I don't want to argue the rest of the bill, but let's...
Well, there's just several ways you can start commitment.
Yourself.
Charles Williamson, Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. Madam Chair, there's several ways you can seek commitment. One of them is a two-position hold, which I think generally does result in custody, although I'm not sure it's required to result in custody. You can also go down and swear out an affidavit at the courthouse, and then it's several days before a person is actually brought to court and may not be placed in custody until after a hearing. So that there's certainly no guarantee that just because someone seeks commitment that they're going to be confined.
Okay, let's talk about the other parts of the bill, folks. Well, we're waiting for the other one. I know other folks, other members have had concerns about the bill in general, and I want you to read it over and see, because we've spent more time on this bill than a whole lot of other kinds of issues, and I do want to decide up or down on this bill in the next few minutes.
Which, Madam Chair, if I may be so bold, which of these in here are we supposed to read? The hand engrossed one? That one there, okay. Yeah,
but also look at sub B, which is an amendment that's now.
Okay, I've got a hand engrossed in here somewhere. Two letters from the...
No.
I just saw it. There it is. That one?
No. It's right in the beginning of the packet somewhere. Here it is right here.
Okay. Thank you. Madam Chair?
But Senator Grinsky.
I'm just going to reiterate something I presented last time, and that is that, as I understood it from the testimony we had, the ethical obligations of psychotherapists at the present time already talk about the kinds of things they're supposed to do with these people. The testimony, as I heard it, indicated that it wasn't clear enough, and that's why they needed this bill. Well, it seems to me that, they need to deal with their own ethical problems if that's their problem, not come in here and do this. I think the real thrust of this bill is the limit on liability, the case in California, the case in Oregon, that expands psychotherapist liability, I think prompted this, basically. And I just don't see why we should limit liability in this respect for these kinds of people.
Senator Brennan?
It has nothing to do with what the Senator brought up, but Senator Brockman's request. I'm working from the assumption, I didn't hear an answer to it. I know Catherine went down and talked to him. I'm working from the assumption we're looking at redraft of Senate Bill 412 dated March 13th, and to that, and that includes the dash two amendments, and to that we being proposed this amendment you just passed out, right?
Yes, that deals okay. with
that the effective date.
And effective date action. That's what we're looking at. And it specifies who to whom they have to communicate the threat, et cetera. Senator Shoemaker.
Madam Chair, I've just looked very quickly at this commitment procedure, and I don't see anything in here that would require the psychotherapist to detain the person until you can have a commitment hearing. And it looks like the commitment hearing is a rather long and involved procedure that requires an investigation, which may go on for a while. It is true that there are provisions that a judge may issue a warrant of detention. That's permissive and not mandatory, and it too has a procedure. So I guess I'm not satisfied that that is an appropriate safeguard of a person who is threatened with harm.
Okay.
And that's the whole purpose of this thing, is to protect a person threatened with harm, and to protect the psychotherapist if he protects that person who's threatened with harm.
Okay, would you like to offer an amendment?
Well, I would like to move that we strike from the dash two amendment, line 13.
Okay.
Can I do so?
Senator, Senator, I guess I'd ask, before we do this, I'd like to move the amendment. I'd like to, the chair would move the amendments 412-2 for discussion purposes, and then I'll take the motion to amend it.
Okay.
Is there objections to adopting 412-2 just for purposes of getting the bill into a shape that we can discuss. Hearing none, so ordered now. Senator Shoemaker has moved that we delete on line 13 of LC-2 that line dealing with civil commitment.
Yeah, I think we leave in the word or and move it up to line 12.
Okay. Discussion? Call the roll, please.
This is just on the motion to...
On the motion to delete line 13.
No.
Rockman?
This is... I'm sorry, I'm confused here, and I apologize.
Senator Shoemaker has moved to delete line 24A on your hand and gross bill, the redraft bill, which is... corresponding line 13 on LC.
Yeah, this one.
Madam Chair, maybe I could have a minute of discussion then before we continue the vote. My concern is this, that the purpose of the bill is to protect somebody who is being threatened by a patient of a psychotherapist. And the trade-off for providing that the psychotherapist will do what he or she can to warn that person or the person's relatives is to protect the psychotherapist from liability for breaking the doctor-patient privilege, and essentially that's it. And it seems to me that's an appropriate trade-off, that it is important to protect people from physical harm. The psychotherapist is really in a bind when this is unfolding before him. And the society is better served by protecting the person threatened with harm than protecting the confidence between the psychotherapist and the patient. However, this seeking commitment as a way of protecting the patient, I don't think that does the job. Because that takes a while. And the patient, protecting the person, because that takes a while, and the patient can leave the clinic and go off and do the damage that he's threatened. And this imposes a duty on the psychotherapist to do one of these things. I guess I should have prefaced my remarks with that. The psychotherapist has a duty to warn under this bill. And that duty should be discharged by his actually warning and doing something that actually protects the person threatened. And merely seeking commitment seems like it's a way out.
Madam Chair, if I could respond to that, but doesn't it, in the lines just above that, they've already reported this person to the police department, and this doesn't making a threat on someone's life or personal property or whatever this may be, doesn't that constitute an arrest? I mean, can't you arrest somebody for having done that?
Well, the thing is that these are disjunctive. They can do it by notifying the police or by seeking commitment or by notifying the Psychiatric Security Review Board. So you wouldn't have to notify the person threatened or their parent or the police if you seek commitment. Diarrhea.
Yes, Senator. In the original bill, it was an and.
Yeah.
And it was changed through the draft, through the amendments. Correct.
Well, but I'm correct, though. As it stands, the psychotherapist's duty to protect the threatened person will be fulfilled, as it's proposed, by doing nothing more than seeking commitment. Doesn't protect the threatened person.
Would you buy it if we changed it back to and?
No, I don't think it. I mean, I think it's well and good to seek commitment. I mean, I think they should certainly be encouraged to do that, but I think they also ought to warn people that are threatened. Maybe I'm missing something.
I don't I don't think you'd necessarily have grounds to commit somebody. Grounds for commitment are not necessarily the same as
I grant you that. I grant you that.
So, I mean, it's not always going to be the same circumstance.
Well, I guess I'll entertain the motion, and we'll vote, continue to vote on it and see where we are. I think that if there is a concern, we can, in fact, folks can try to work it through in the House a little better, but
I had a different view of that than the senator here, that it would be an action to try to protect this other person seeking commitment would be. That's why it's here, I think. Am I wrong in reading it that way?
Well, we're debating on whether, in fact, he's seeking commitment. In fact, is it appropriate protection?
I understand that, but it is being offered here as one alternative of three to be chosen to protect this other person.
Right. And I question that it's
an appropriate action. Protection. Right.
Yeah.
It's also, Madam Chair, it's also the least restrictive thing to do, because in the other cases, they have to divulge confidences. I don't think they would necessarily have to do that to start commitment proceedings.
I agree that's true.
And that might be the course they would take most likely rather than warning.
Okay, I think we've had enough discussion. Let's, retake the vote, Kiska, please, on Senator Shoemaker's motion to delete on the official LC 412-2, the seeking of commitment on Chapter 426, Line 13, which is a sub B. Okay.
Brenneman?
No.
Brockman?
No.
Lindsay?
No.
No?
Aye.
Shoemaker?
Aye.
Brenner?
Aye.
Oh.
Aye. Motion carried. Now, we have the bill before
I'll
us.
I'll move the bill.
Wait, we need a Catherine Weber's amendment dated 4489, which merely says the provisions of this bill apply only to causes of action arising on or after the effective date
of the act. I'll move the Weber Amendment 4489.
Okay. Senator Weber moves the Weber Amendment. Are there objections? So ordered. Now. Senator Shoemaker moves Senate Bill 412 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. I think we've had enough.
Aye.
Brockman?
Aye.
Lindsay?
No.
No?
No.
Shoemaker?
Aye.
Brenner?
No.
Collins? Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Okay. Now we have before us the Catherine is on her way out the door. Thank you very much for coming and working in the evening. We'll change counsel, and we have Jack. This is a little warm-up, folks. We have two bills remaining.
You're right, we probably will be here 3 hours.
Madam Chair, I'd serve notice of a possible minority report on 412.
Okay.
That took you long enough.
Well, I had to make sure if I had two or three to join, one or two others to join with me. I got at least one more.
Why don't you just make the recall and make the motion of the table?
It's going to be an unholy alliance.
Right. It's just a little liability issue there.
Very little liability.
A little liability
very,
issue,
very,
I'm sure.
Very little liability.
Okay. Let's start with Senate Bill 275.
Senate Bill 275, you will recall, is the hearsay bill. We have some amendments in front of you that we've gone through before. I can go through those again if that's the wish. There is also an additional amendment, new material from the Oregon Psychological Association. You'll find that in your file as well. As you may recall, there are some on page 2 of
the document that I've typed up for the committee, proposed amendments March 1989. There are some amendments that have been agreed to by a representative of the District Attorneys Association, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and the Governor's Council. The amendments on the first page are those amendments that have been proposed that have not been agreed to ahead of time. There are several interested parties here, representatives of OCDLA, the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the Governor's Council, as well as John Collins from the Yamhill County District Attorney's
Office. Why don't you go over for the committee the three issues of the bill that we're dealing with here?
Right. If you'll turn your attention to the first page of the amendments that I've typed up, I'd remind the committee these are in concept form. These are amendments on 275 that have been suggested by OCDLA, and they are, as I said, here to answer questions. The first major ground or major proposed amendment is one that I think Senator Shoemaker originally raised as an issue, at least remarked on it, and that amendment would amend out unavailability of the child as grounds for allowing hearsay statement. If this amendment were adopted, it would leave the bill in a position where it would still allow hearsay statements to be brought in as corroboration of the child's testimony when the child testifies. The further amendments are basically options to delete grounds for allowing hearsay in, and those grounds are incompetence or lack of memory. They would delete those from the definition of unavailability. The committee could choose to adopt deleting one or both, or for that matter, neither of those. Finally, at the bottom of the page, you'll find some additional language under paragraph D, and that language was originally suggested as a substitution for deleting incompetence or lack of memory as grounds for unavailability. That language was suggested by some national bar materials and basically says that the child is unavailable when the child persists in refusing to testify because of fear or some related reason despite repeated judicial requests to do so.